The next matter is in re the trustee's sale, Arrington.
May it please the court, Brian Hollock appearing on behalf of Thomas and Susan Arrington. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this case centers around the interpretation of RCW 61-24-080, subsection 3. There are two respondents, Visual Graphics and Bank of America. Generally, the trial court has an immense amount of discretion when making interpretations of RCW 61-24-080, subsection 3, and that's actually why we're here today. The real problem is that there isn't enough direction to the trial court, and what ends up happening is they reach for an equitable result, and that's clearly what happened in the case of Visual Graphics. Visual Graphics was a judgment creditor, all by it. Admittedly, Susan Arrington is not a sympathetic person. She embezzled from her employer. She went to prison for it, and her employer got a civil judgment against her. And then following the foreclosure, it became an issue of, well, who trumps, the judgment creditor or the homestead? Well, if it weren't for the unsympathetic facts, it would normally be the homestead. What troubled Judge Kurtz was, here's a person who intentionally harmed another person, and then is now attempting to avail themselves of a homestead against them. That's really the crux of what Judge Kurtz was getting to, and I understand.
Can you address the factual existence of a homestead?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. The issue really is we don't have to go too far. The homestead statute is automatic. You literally set foot in the place for one day. This is my home. It's my homestead. It's automatic, and that's really it. The factual issue becomes, did she abandon it? And where that comes into play is a Visual Graphics claim that somehow, by virtue of her incarceration, she intentionally abandoned her homestead. We don't find any authority for that. And again, it's more of
what do you do with the statute, which says if you're absent from the homestead for more than 6 months, if you want to preserve it, you need to file an election?
Well, you have to be intentionally absent. And we're arguing that her incarceration wasn't an intentional absence, and I guess we can say, well, she committed the crime intentionally, so therefore whatever flowed from it would happen. And that's okay if the court wants to reach that result, but the court has to actually say it so that the lower courts can say, okay, aha, here we go. We have something to hang our hats on. The Nelson case is the closest we have, and in the Nelson case it says no. Incarceration is not a voluntary absence. The other problem we
Well, the Nelson case, you had a couple who was still married and the other spouse residing in the property, and that spouse was entitled to the homestead. Here you've got a dissolution, and the spouse that's remaining was awarded possession. It's not even clear that she has a right after the dissolution to assert a homestead, is it?
Well, it was, Your Honor. The issue of whether she would have the right to the asserting the homestead wasn't what came up. What came up was whether or not she abandoned it, and it's not clear from the record that she was even absent from the property for 180 days before the foreclosure takes place. So it becomes questionable whether she would even have been under an obligation to file a declaration of homestead. But what Judge Kurtz got at, and what really the crux of his ruling with respect to Visual Graphics was, look, this is a person who harmed another person, and then this type of judgment is different. And again, it's okay, but it's not found in the law. We don't feel that should be a discretionary call on the part of the judge. That should be something really the legislature should have said. And the legislature never carved out an exception for people who intentionally harmed other people. And in fact, look, every judgment creditor can claim they received some injury on the part of a judgment debtor. And so if we are to extend it that far, we really cause ourselves problems.
Well, maybe, but I mean, the point is, you just said she wasn't there for 6 months?
She wasn't gone
for 6 months?
We don't know that. It's clear from the record. She was convicted in November of 2009. She gets incarcerated sometime thereafter, but we're not clear when, and then the foreclosure happens in June of 2010. Your Honor, with respect to Bank of America, the problem with that is, again, one of...
What happened in June 2010?
That's when the foreclosure takes place.
When was the judgment in the foreclosure?
The judgment, it was not a judicial foreclosure, so it was a non-judicial foreclosure. There wasn't a judgment.
Okay.
With respect to Bank of America, Your Honor, the problem we have there is one that we know that Fleet didn't actually receive notice. That's not what the argument is. The argument is, well, we're Bank of America, we're their successor, therefore everything that flows from Fleet flows to us. And that's okay, but the problem we have is right now banks get to play both sides of the aisle on this. They can claim that when, let's say, there's no surplus funds or very little surplus funds and the economics work to their advantage, they say, no, we didn't really get notice. You sent notice to the old bank. We're the new bank. Yeah, we bought them, but we didn't actually receive notice. So we're actually an omitted creditor. So we're going to go after the new purchaser, and we're going to tell them, hey, guess what? You bought subject to our lien, and either you pay us or we're going to foreclose on you. On the same time, without having any authority to go on at the trial court level, they can pull the reverse argument, which is what is being made now, which is, no, service on the old people is fine. We're the new people, but service on the old party is fine. And the old bank, everything that works with them works with us, and therefore we now are not an omitted creditor. We were eliminated by the operation of the foreclosure, and therefore we have a right to seek a remedy under RCWA 6124080. Without a ruling from a higher level court, we just don't know which one stands.
And is it possible the legislature intended to allow a secured creditor both?
No. That would be a wholly inequitable result. I mean, that would be giving them basically both bites at the apple, and that's really not fair. What we really want to do is we want to say, look, there has to be a rule. Now, our position is the rule should be strictly construed. You get real notice. And if you want to assert a claim that you are a creditor and defense is an issue, then the onus should be on you to file an assignment of your deed of trust. And if you choose not to, then you should be precluded from raising any defenses associated therewith. And so really all we want is a ruling from the court. We want to pin the bank's ears down. I think actually Bank of America is choosing the wrong position. I think that the position we're arguing for is better for them, because now they're going to be in a position where they're really not going to receive notice. They're going to have bought all of these loans. People are going to be serving them at the old notice address. They're not going to get actual notice. And if that becomes the rule, that's what they get to be stuck with. But what we don't want to do is let them have both. They can't claim they didn't get notice on the one side when it benefits them, and then on the other side say, no, we really did get notice when it suits their purposes. So that's really what the crux of the matter is with respect to Fleet and Bank of America. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. You've got 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Ronna Collin-Clark, and I'm counsel for Respondent Bank of America. Counsel for Visual Graphics and I would like to divide our time evenly at 5 minutes aside, unless the Court has another preference.
Okay. Proceed.
Your Honors, as discussed, Bank of America purchased Fleet National Bank's parent company in 2004. When it did so, it merged with Fleet, becoming the successor in interest to all of Fleet's assets, including the 2001 promissory note and deed of trust executed by the Arringtons in this matter. As discussed earlier by counsel, that deed of trust was foreclosed upon in the summer of 2010 through non-judicial foreclosure. Non-judicial foreclosure in Washington is governed by the Washington State Deed of Trust Act. Parties all agree here that that act is a strict compliance statute. And as such, the trustee who is conducting that foreclosure must strictly comply with the rules of the statute. RCW 6124040 subsection 1 sets forth what the trustee must do in order to provide effective notice of trustee's sale to parties. The statute provides very clearly that the trustee is to mail notice to all parties who have a lien interest of record at the address provided for in the record. There is no dispute on the record below that the trustee did this exactly as required by statute. There is also no dispute on the record below that the trustee had any other knowledge of any other parties of interest in the 2001 Arrington Deed of Trust. In other words, that's to say that the trustee did not know that Bank of America had acquired Fleet's interest. Had the trustee known under the statute, it would have been required to provide mail notice to Bank of America. Absent such a knowledge, the trustee did exactly what it was supposed to do under the statute, which is mail notice to the party of record, which was Fleet, at the address provided for in Fleet's deed of trust, the record providing notice. So, Your Honor, this is a strict compliance statute. There's no dispute below that the trustee did exactly what it was supposed to do. Instead, I believe the petitioners here are arguing that the trustee is required to provide actual notice to Bank of America, actual notice to the parties. Now, the statute clearly shifts the burden here from the trustee to the creditors to provide updated notice at their choice, at their election, of their current address. Now,
so your position is that your client couldn't have had it both ways, as counsel has suggested?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And in fact, actually allowing a creditor to have it both ways would go a long ways towards destabilizing land title interest as obtained through deed of trust foreclosure sales. The parties who purchase at trustee sale rely on the warranties provided in the trustee's deed upon sale, one of which is that it has properly mailed notification to all parties of record in order to take title to that property. Allowing a bank to later come back and say, oh, wait, I didn't get notice because you didn't mail to the correct address and I didn't ever let anyone know, it would basically undermine a third-party purchaser's interest in a debt trustee sale. The bank either needs to have actual update the notice of record, or take the risk that it may not get notice. However, in the present case, Bank of America neither updated the record and had notice of the case, as is warranted by its prompt petitioning for the surplus funds. Bank of America is clearly aware that the statute shifts the risk to creditors and has taken steps to notify and find out when its interests are being affected, as it did here, as it obtained counsel and properly moved for dispersal of the surplus funds. The statute should not shift the burden to the trustee. That would be an onerous burden to the trustee. And, Your Honor, to plaintiff's or petitioner's position that that Bank of America is an omitted junior lien creditor, Fleet and Bank of America are one and the same. Notice to Fleet is imputed notice to Bank of America. It is not an omitted creditor. And even if the court backs away from that position, which I don't think it should, Bank of America technically is not required. The trustee is not required to literally address a notice of trustee sale to Bank of America and mail it to Bank of America under the plain language of the statute. And it's a long-held tenet of statutory interpretation in Washington that we, when reviewing the intent of the legislature interpreting a statute, we look to the plain meaning of the statute. And frankly, RCW 61-24-040 could not be any plainer. Mailing notice is what the statute requires, not actual notice. The trustee is not required to go on an elaborate search to find and discover every single party who could hold an interest and then make sure that they get actual notice. And so with that, Your Honor, I would hold that the court's dispersal to Bank of America as the first position remaining deed of trust holder was correct and should be upheld.
Thank you, counsel.
Honorable Court, my name is Martin Snodgrass. I represent Respondent Visual Graphics. And as is frequently the case, bad facts make for tough legal decisions.
Well, one of the contentions is that the record does not reflect that Arrington was absent from the property for the period 6 months prior to the June trustee sale. Could you address that, please?
The order of commitment is in the record, Your Honor. That order of commitment was dated November 16th of 2009, I believe it's clerk's paper 237. I'm not sure of the specific site. As is the findings and judgment and order of immediate commitment. I think that's adequate. I don't recall the specific language that was in Ms. Arrington's affidavit or certificate as to how long she had been committed, but I believe the record's clear that she had been in jail for at least 9 months by the time that the hearing was held, or the trustee sale was held, and the hearing was held. And the argument that counsel makes that one must affirmatively abandon the homestead before there's a requirement to file the declaration of non-abandonment was, of course, previously rejected by this court in the Brown case, the trustee sale of Brown case, which was decided after our case was argued and briefed. But in that case, in fact, same firm made that precise argument. Their clients had abandoned the property. The argument was that the presumption of abandonment found in 613.050 kicked in automatically. The argument was made. The Browns contended that they must affirmatively abandon the homestead. I'm quoting from the opinion. This argument is without merit in light of the plain language of 6.13.050, that mere absence from the property for 6 months constitutes a presumption of abandonment. I think that statute goes a long way to do away with any question as to whether or not imprisonment would be considered an abandonment or not. In the old cases, the Nelson case, at that time, I don't recall whether there was actually an ability to file a declaration of non-abandonment. And in fact, it wasn't necessary because, as the court pointed out, Mrs. Nelson was still living on the property, and it was her homestead that was being protected.
Had not abandoned it, she would have the homestead, right? Even this argument that it'd be terrible, be a terrible result because she embezzled it. I mean, that may be, but the statute still lets the homestead trump that, doesn't it?
Let me answer that with a typical lawyer answer: yes and no. Yes, there would be a homestead. However, that would create the other bundle of rights that are found in the homestead: possession after a sheriff's sale, the right to redeem, et cetera, et cetera. However, the statute talks about the sale, about the distribution of the proceeds, and when in extending the homestead protection to the proceeds from a sale, there's a requirement of good faith. Now, there's no requirement of good faith in one declaring a homestead. You need have no good faith or one way or the other. But in order for the proceeds from a sale to be protected, the court must be found that they are acquired in good faith for the purposes of acquiring a new homestead. And I believe that's what the court made its finding on as to the proceeds themselves, that with her incarcerated, given the circumstances, given her instructions to counsel to simply hold the money in trust, there could not be a finding that the proceeds had been acquired in good faith for the purposes of acquiring another homestead. Now, I don't know that that's an issue that's ever been decided or even looked at by any level of appellate court, and frankly,
does the record support, or is there anything in the record that supports that was the thinking of the trial court? Because it's represented to us as the trial court kind of becoming overly moralistic and just deciding that, you know, as nice as the homestead is, it's not there for people who are bad, which of course is not true.
It may not, Your Honor, have been well described by the trial court in his oral findings. But I believe inherent in that finding is the finding of a lack of good faith. Now, how the court expresses it, you know, we all wish we could go back and fix things, obviously. But I think that was the second prong of his finding that the homestead was not valid. A, there was no residence. The property had been abandoned. B, the proceeds themselves, even if the homestead had been effective, the proceeds themselves were not protected because with her incarcerated, her delivery of the funds to her attorney, that there was no good faith intent to acquire another homestead. And indeed, well over a year has passed, and there's been no evidence of any desire to acquire a homestead. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree with everything she said. really, we're not at odds on the facts. So it really is an issue of if that's their position, that's what we want the law of the land to be. We just don't want banks flip-flopping when it serves our purposes. With respect to Visual Graphics, Your Honor, it's important. One, the presumption, this declaration of homestead has to be filed. I'm going to read from RCW 6.13050. The homestead is presumed abandoned if the owner vacates the property for a continuous period of at least 6 months. However, if an owner is going to be absent from the homestead for more than 6 months but does not intend to abandon the homestead and has no other principal residence, the owner may execute and acknowledge in the same manner the declaration of home, paraphrasing the declaration of homestead. They don't have to. As long as they intend to reside at the property, and she resided at the property right up to the point of incarceration. With respect to RCW 6.13070, and there's an issue of, well, what did she plan on doing with the funds? That statute talks about voluntary sales of the property. If you plan to voluntarily dispose of the property, then you have to take those homestead funds and use them for something, for another homestead. A foreclosure is, by definition, the ultimate involuntary sale of property. And so with respect to that argument, Your Honor, we feel that 6.13070 is an inapplicable statute. If we read Judge Kurtz's ruling, it is seething with his...
As to the 6 months, apparently we have an order of immediate commitment in the record dated in about November 2009. Is that not proof that she's going into prison? What do you need more than that?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not a criminal attorney. I don't know exactly what the how that administratively works. I don't know when they go in. And in any event, what we're really saying is now that there is a prison exception, that going to prison, being incarcerated, is in fact abandonment. So, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.